Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley's conversation with Upper Hudson Green Party Chair Caleb Winters about political corruption and election fraud in Troy and Rensselaer County in the wake of Troy Councilwoman Kimberly Ash McPherson's recent guilty plea to federal ballot fraud charges and resignation from the council. And then our regular plastics correspondent, Alexis Goldsmith, joins us in the studio to recap the legislative session and tell us about what's coming up. Later on, Elizabeth Press talks with Carolyn Nagy about the failed good cause eviction bill and the protests supporting it. After that, attorney Kathy Manley, who helped defend Arif and Hossein after their 2004 arrest, speaks with Mark Dunley in anticipation of Friday's screening of Witness, a documentary film about the case. And finally, Blaze Bryant brings us this week's climate update with meteorologist Hugh Johnson. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that the widespread use of fake online identities by police troubles civil liberty advocates. For instance, the FBI has provided the Chicago Police Department with dummy internet identities, which the department has used to surveil and prosecute individuals protesting police brutality. The police argue that they use such practices to help catch sexual predators and/or identify dangerous extremists.
A new report shows that the cities of Schenectady and Albany ranked 2nd and 12th worst in the country, respectively, for dangers to pedestrians. The ranking was compiled by an insurance company, which found that 38.1 drivers per 10,000 in Schenectady were cited for failing to yield to a pedestrian, which is 9.4 times higher than the national average. Schenectady also led the state in the percentage of bad drivers.
Last year, the City of Albany police took 140 handguns from traffic stops, arrests, and raids, one of the highest number in recent memory. The Times Union reports that this year the department is on pace to top that number with 74 handguns taken off the streets so far this year.
The Pride Center of the Capital Region hosted the Capital Pride Parade and Festival in Washington Park on Sunday for the first time since the start of the pandemic 3 years ago.
The Gazette reports that residents were surprised when the iconic GE sign at the foot of Erie Boulevard in Schenectady was switched over to rainbow colors to mark Pride Month through the end of June.
A year after 12-year-old Oliver Talbot and 11-year-old Sheila Marino spoke in front of the Village of Scotia officials with a petition to allow for skateboarding on Scotia's streets and sidewalks, the Gazette reports that a new law has been introduced to allow such action. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. If you like what you hear, you can find all of these stories that you hear and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
And to learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Kimberly Ash McPherson recently pleaded guilty on federal ballot fraud charges, and her resignation from the Troy City Council are just the latest in political corruption in Troy and Rensselaer County. Mark Dunley explores the situation with Green Party's Caleb Winters.
We're joined today by Caleb Winters, who is chair of the Upper Hudson Green Party, and we asked Caleb to join us to talk about the recent resignation of Kimberly Ash McPherson after she pled guilty to various election frauds. She's had some relationship with the Green Party in the past. I will also note that this has not been covered much in the mainstream media that Kimberly Ash McPherson, representing District 2, North Central Troy, southern part of Landsberg, her brother, who was the police chief out in Hoosick Falls, also recently was forced to resign due to official misconduct, but he is also part of the investigation ongoing by the state and federal authorities into election fraud right now. In this particular election cycle, they seem very heavily focused upon the Republican, though we know, unfortunately, that corruption has been a bipartisan effort, particularly in Rensselaer County and the city of Troy. So, Caleb, what's the relationship between the Green Party and Kimberly Ash McPherson?
We don't have any official relationship, but Kim Ash McPherson has stolen our ballot line multiple times through a process called Opportunity to Ballot, along with her friends, too. You know, Rodney Wiltshire, who was a Democrat, lied and claimed he was a Green and tried to steal our ballot line. Council President Carmela Mantello, who's a Republican, also tried to steal our ballot line. Jim Gulley, Mike Stammel, who's in the legislature and also the city of Rensselaer. You know, this has been going on a long time, but Kim Ash McPherson has been an issue ever since she got into office. But this is nothing new. I mean, the Democrats and Republicans have been playing this game all over the state of New York, especially in Rensselaer County, for many decades. And we've been trying to call attention to this. For whatever reason, it caught the attention of the FBI and other officials. Have a feeling that it was because the Democrats did so poorly in their election last year. But yeah, that's basically the relationship. She's refused to talk to us. We had her on our most wanted poster for the Opportunity to Ballot most wanted, which was about 50% Democrat, 50% Republican. So this is not a new issue. The only thing new here is that there was the gumption in the FBI and the other officials to prosecute and investigate.
So what should you think, you know, should happen now? The mayor, Democrat, you know, tried to appoint the Democrat who ran in that particular district, you know, came in second. I know Carmen Mantello, the president, Republican, sometimes steals Green Party line, you know, sort of blocked that. So now it seems to be up in the air. There would be a special election in, I guess, relatively soon. But, you know, what is the Green Party's perspective on what should happen to deal with this seat?
The Green Party's perspective is that no one should be appointed to any position. I mean, this is a huge problem in local government and state government. You know, there's a lot of appointed officials who answer to who they were appointed to from. So we think there should be a special election held and no appointment done. The last time the Democrats did this, after Mark McGrath, who was a Republican, was caught using the N-word in a voicemail message, and they appointed Deb Garrett to that position, and then, you know, let her finish out Mark McGrath's term, and then didn't let her know about the reelection, and basically screwed her out of any opportunity to run for an election the following time. They already had a new candidate lined up, so I'd hate to see the same thing happen to another Democratic candidate who didn't get a whole lot of support during that run. So yeah, we think that a special election should be held. And honestly, we'd really like to see the districts go away and to see proportional representation in the city of Troy.
Is there any chance that the Green Party will field a candidate? I know that the Democrats basically have an all-out war on the independent third parties in New York State, and it basically killed their right to be on as a ballot party, but they still have the right to run as independent. And the Greens talked about the possibility of running somebody for this election once it is scheduled.
Yeah, we're going to start reaching out to our Greens in that district and start trying to field a candidate once the details emerge of when the special election will be, when the petitioning period will be. And at this point, we have to petition as an independent candidate. So if that's going to be a separate petitioning drive from the major parties.
Now, this particular district, you know, sort of North Central Troy, particularly North Central Troy, is one of the poorest communities, actually, in the entire United States. And then, you know, Landsberg, Southern Landsberg, you know, has the city of Troy really dealt with some of the issues, you know, plaguing, you know, that neighborhood? We hear a lot about, you know, maybe doing something about gun violence. We don't seem to hear a lot about dealing with poverty and unemployment and the other economic injustice issues, racial issues, you know, facing that community.
They haven't done a whole lot. The focus has not been on District 2. And I would like to point out, too, that, you know, District 2, I mean, along with other places in Troy, but part of what Kim Ash McPherson was charged with was falsifying absentee ballots. And a lot of those come from low-income residents who all happen to be taking the same trip to Florida or Paris or, you know, going on vacation, or they've got tickets to some event. But yeah, the city of Troy has really failed District 2, and we'd really like to see an anti-poverty program. You know, we see more policing in that district than any other district just because it's poor. You know, a district like mine, I'm in District 3 in Troy, we see very little police presence and very little crime. But with a higher police presence, we see quite a massive amount of crime in District 2, and we'd like to see some anti-poverty measures and some opportunities for the young folks there to be able to do that. I mean, there's some small projects that they've been working on, but not on a mass scale that it needs. There's also an issue with obtaining groceries. It's nice to see Capital Roots, you know, offering reasonably priced healthy food there on a regular basis, but we'd like to see more.
We mentioned low-income voters. I mean, both the Democrats and the Republicans apparently have been involved over the years in Troy in basically fraudulent activities involving residents of, you know, public housing. And, you know, that's the type of situation where, you know, people are pretty desperate to get into, you know, affordable housing or from the waiting list. And, you know, even when they discovered that there's, you know, election fraud being done in their name, they, you know, they're sort of reluctant to say anything because they're very worried they'll get evicted. You know, what are some of the, you know, plans in the last couple of minutes that the Greens have, you know, for the city of Troy moving forward, or visions for the city of Troy?
We'd really like to see the city of Troy enact a local Green New Deal, as Ithaca has done. We'd really like to see more welcoming of immigrants. You know, the sanctuary city movement has kind of died down, but certainly the need has not. And we would like to run local candidates when they come up. You know, this is Mayor Madden's last term, so that'll be an open seat for mayor. You know, and who knows what the fallout of this investigation is going to be. You know, Steve McLaughlin, the county executive, is involved, who's moving municipal offices from the city of Troy to, you know, out into the suburbs. Mike Stammel down the city of Rensselaer. So there's a lot to work on in Troy. I mean, we've seen the pilot program for the composting program, but we'd like to see that expanded. We'd like to see zoning change, especially to support small local agriculture.
You know, last year, there's been a big fight about early voting in the city of Troy. And it was always strange to me, why are the Democrats not putting places that allow low-income people to vote? Allegedly, that's their base.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge problem. I mean, New York State has a law that the county board of elections and the state board of elections has to have an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. I should say the law says that whatever the major parties are that are in control, which are the Dems and Republicans. So they make the decisions that benefit those parties. And, you know, the Democrats are always saying, oh, we're better than the Republicans, but that's not too hard to beat these days. So, yeah, I don't know what the deal is. We've called on them to make changes, and it's always too little, too late.
Well, thank you very much, Caleb Winters, chair of the Upper Hudson Green Party. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Mark Dunley speaking with Caleb Winters, and we will be covering that as we know more information.
Joining us up next is Alexis Goldsmith, our plastics correspondent and national organizing director at Beyond Plastics, here to recap for us this year's legislative session for plastics bills and let us know what's coming up. Alexis, thanks for dropping in.
Thank you for having me. Well, glad to be back.
We've talked about There were five main bills that you were talking with us about. The EPR, bigger metal bottle bill, plastic straws by request, plastic cutlery by request, and oppose advantage recycling bill. How did they fare in this last session?
Well, I can say the good news is that we did not get any bad bills passed.
That is good. That is good.
Sorry, I need to just take a pause here and commend you for that, because that is never to be taken for granted. Well done.
Thank you. So the big tug of war in the New York State Legislature around plastics this year was extended producer responsibility. So extended producer responsibility is a law that requires producers and major consumer brands like Coca-Cola and all your store brands to take responsibility for the end of life of their packaging. Because currently we pay, taxpayers pay, to dispose of all that packaging, incinerate or recycle it. So we had three different proposals this year. We had one from Governor Hochul that she put in the budget. We had a bill from Senator Kaminsky in the state Senate, and we had a bill from Assemblymember Engelbreit in the legislature, in the assembly. So we managed to get Governor Hochul's bill out of the budget because it was seriously flawed. It gave basically all of the power to the producers to set their own timeline and targets for dealing with packaging. And that's like giving the tobacco industry all the power to reduce smoking, or the NRA the power to enforce gun safety. So that was bad. And unfortunately, Senator Kaminsky's bill was similar, and there was a real attitude of incrementalism in the legislature, where there was this attitude that we just wanted to get something passed, anything passed, to get money to recyclers and municipal waste haulers, and not really paying attention to the details. Is this going to actually reduce our packaging problem? Luckily, Assemblymember Engelbreit's bill was very strong, and we are still advocating for his bill to pass. That's Assembly Bill 10185, Extended Producer Responsibility Act. But it was 2-on-1. So our whole strategy was to get the Assembly to stay strong and not compromise on their bill, which thankfully they did. So we're going to come back next January, when the Assembly is back in session, and hopefully get a Senate sponsor to introduce the same as bill for Assemblymember Engelbreit's bill, and get EPR passed in the state. And if we do, it will be the strongest EPR law in the country.
When you're talking about producer responsibility, you mentioned Coca-Cola. These are big, powerful companies. What is the power of the lobbying from these mega corporations that are fighting against your work?
Sure. Well, they certainly have a lot of political power, and they have a lot of social power as well, because these are brands that we know and love. We're very sentimental over our brands, and food is very much a part of our social life and, you know, every aspect of our life. So they do have a lot of power, and they tend to say, let us set the rates and dates, because we can handle it. We can do it. We know what we're doing. Let us take care of the problem. But the issue is that time and time again, we've seen these major consumer brands come out with big promises for how they're going to reduce their plastic pollution, and then they never follow through. So we know that voluntary measures are never going to work, which is why those rates and dates need to be set in the law. And just to put it into perspective, Coca-Cola produces 200,000 plastic bottles every minute. So this is a ton of plastic. I mean, this is just an incomprehensible amount of plastic waste that winds up in the environment for generations, and it's used for a very short period of time, its useful life. So we need to replace these systems comes with reuse and refill systems with materials that are actually recyclable. And we need to also get toxics out of packaging and everything. All of those measures are included in Assemblymember Engelbreit's bill.
But Coca-Cola and Bill Nye recently said that they have a closed loop with their bottles plastic system.
Yeah, it's basically smoke and mirrors. Recycling has been the answer since the 80s. And they've done a very good PR campaign, you know, handbags made out of plastic bottles and whatnot. But the reality is that in the United States, less than 6% of plastics are recycled. There's so much plastic being produced at an increasing rate that by 2050, scientists estimate that there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish. And we already have more than one ton of plastic for every person on Earth. And that's only increasing. So we need these measures right away to reduce the amount of plastic that we're actually producing in the first place. We can't recycle our way out of this.
Absolutely. I can't resist throwing in a theoretical observation because that's how I roll. But it strikes me that this, as with so many things, really heralds a paradigm shift, which is that the cause of environmental justice generally has basically said we have to stop making all these fundamental issues externalities. And basically it's internalizing the externalities and saying there is a cost there. Someone's paying it. The planet is paying it. Our future is paying for it. And it's time to actually reckon with these costs. And the response is still dealing on the original level, not the next paradigm, which is we need to internalize all these externalities, but rather, no, I'm not going to do it. You do it.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there. It's estimated that if the United States landfilled all of its plastic waste, which we don't, we burn some of it and we export a lot of it. It costs taxpayers $5 billion a year just to landfill it, but it's even more expensive to burn it or export it. But the other externality is the human cost of plastics. So plastics are made from oil and gas. They are produced in very toxic polluting facilities, and those facilities are in people's community. And time and time again, we see these facilities in Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities who are bearing the health effects, the mental health effects, their families are being affected. So we need to think about that as well in all of these plastic issues.
Thank you for entertaining that idea. We've only got a couple of minutes left. So briefly, what should we be looking forward to aside from this new getting a Senate co-sponsor and bringing this bill out strong at the beginning of the next session? What else is on the horizon?
So at Beyond Plastics, we are working hard to build the grassroots movement to end plastic pollution. And we have an event coming up for Plastic Free July. We're mobilizing our volunteers. And we're asking people to save their packaging waste and take it back to the store that you bought it from.
I love it. That is great.
So this is based on something called plastic attacks that have been done in the UK, where shoppers would leave their plastic waste. But we're modifying it. We didn't want to leave the waste for the store employees to pick up because we care about labor solidarity. So we're asking people to save their packaging and take it back to the store. And that is intended to get media attention on just how much plastic waste our consumer products produce. And that is why we need to pass Assemblymember Engelbreit's bill, which requires a 50% reduction of packaging over 10 years. So if you want to learn more about that, get involved with that, go to beyondplastics.org and contact us through the website. And I can give you, we have a guide to how to do this, all the sample materials. I do a lot of handholding if you've never done organizing before. We really want new people to come to grassroots organizing and make their voices heard, because we're all drowning in plastics and nobody gets any choice basically with how much plastic they consume. And we think that another world is possible and we hope you'll agree. But just quickly, there was another bill I was really anxious about last time I was on. That is the Advanced Recycling Bill. This bill is not moving, thankfully, in the Senate or the Assembly, but we do have our eye on it. So advanced recycling is really just plastic burning. It's an industry ploy to distract from reducing plastics. But we want, again, the Assembly and the Senate to stay strong. Don't pass this bill. So it's not moving, but we're keeping our eye on it.
And we're out of time, but we will have you back next week and looking forward to getting a little bit more in depth. I also had some questions about the straw bill, which is passed in New York City. So we'll see you next week. Thank you so much, Alexis Goldsmith, for joining us on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Alrighty. Next up, it has been an exciting week in housing justice. The recent Albany arraignment of the Good Cause Bill advocates who were arrested in May brought reports of giant cockroaches shutting down the court. Elizabeth Press talks with Carolyn Nagy about the failed Good Cause eviction bill and the protests supporting it.
Lawmakers in Albany wrapped up their session on June 3rd, but several major housing policies that had been on the agenda were not addressed. One to note is the Good Cause Eviction Bill. The legislation would have protected tenants from unjust evictions and rent increases. Here today to talk about Good Cause, the rallies to support the bill in Albany, and protests at the arraignment for those arrested there is Carolyn Nagy of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and she is currently their senior housing strategist. Carolyn, thank you for joining us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, I just wanted to know if you could fill in any more details about Good Cause and why it didn't make it through this term of the legislative session.
Yeah, it was very disappointing that we have a Democratic-controlled legislature and governor, and yet we were unable to pass some very needed statewide protections for tenants in New York. The truth is, in New York State today, unless you're one of the people who has a rent-stabilized apartment in New York City, you really don't have very many rights as a tenant, and specifically the right to stay in your home. What Good Cause would have done was to actually give tenants around New York State protection against unjust evictions and unreasonable rent increases. You know, your landlord can refuse to renew your lease for no reason at all, or because they want to sell the property and make get more money for it, or if they want to convert it into an Airbnb, either by refusing to renew your lease at the end of your lease term, or by giving you such a large rent increase that it's impossible to stay put. And so Good Cause, what it will do, because I do believe that we are going to pass it eventually, it gives tenants a right to a lease renewal so long as they're good tenants. Basically, this affects people who are paying their rent, abiding by the terms of their lease, who just want a right to stay in their home. It also would change how much your landlord can increase your rent to an extent. It's not rent control, If your landlord wants to increase your rent over 3%, the tenant actually has a right to challenge this in court, and then the landlord would need to be able to justify the increase. Then it would be determined whether or not the increase is unreasonable. And here in the Capital Region, I'm really devastated that we didn't get these protections right now, because we know that housing prices have gone up a lot, both for sales and for rents. And I mean, every day, you know, I'm hearing from folks who are really concerned about losing their housing stability. A lot of what we're seeing now with a lot of real estate investment money coming up to cities like Troy, you're seeing a lot of landlords selling to investors, and as part of that, seeking to kick tenants out so that, you know, the new owners can charge much higher rents and, you know, market to wealthier people. Having stable, affordable housing is so important to your health, your ability to be a part of your community, stay where you want to stay, keep your kids in the same school, you know, and really just have a feeling of control. Because when you lose an apartment that was affordable to you, you know, with the market where it is now, it's going to be really hard to find another rental situation. And so that's why it was so disappointing that Good Cause did not pass, despite having a lot of advocates in the Senate and in the Assembly, you know, a number of organizations like the New York Civil Liberties Union signing on to support, and a number of labor unions joining the coalition, you know, as well as some unusual coalition members, like, you know, there is a shelter animal advocacy group, you know, that is signed on to support Good Cause.
Thank you for that, Carolyn. So in May, before the session broke, there was a rally at the state capitol in support of Good Cause. In the end, there were dozens of arrests.
Yes.
At least one appears from the video to be very forceful or violent. You were there that day. Can you just tell us some of your observations of what happened at the rally for Good Cause at the state capitol in May?
Absolutely. So it was, you know, an incredibly inspiring day. We had over 1,000 people filling the legislative office building where we had a large rally, you know, tenants from all over the state, you know, people speaking different languages, different organizations, a lot of elected officials coming out to show support. It was very inspiring. Following the rally at the legislative office building, we then moved to the actual Capitol building, to the Senate and Assembly chambers, where they had a number of people who had signed up to commit nonviolent civil disobedience, where they blocked some entrances to the Senate and to the Assembly. And those folks were prepared and ready to be arrested. There were a lot of people at this rally, at this action, because there's so many people who really care about being able to stay in their home, about extending protections to tenants. A lot of folks who spoke said they personally, you know, were worried that they were going to get evicted this summer without Good Cause passing. So, you know, passions were high and folks were loud. I did not see personally any behavior that really rose to, I think, the level of something that someone would be arrested for, except for the people who were specifically doing civil disobedience. I did see, you know, the Capitol Police were a little bit, I would say, antagonistic. They did seem to be kind of confronting people and escalating conflict. So I didn't actually, you know, see this arrest, although, you know, I know that groups like Citizen Action have condemned what happened. I think it's really concerning because we have in this country the fundamental right to show up at our government and protest, you know, loudly and vigorously. And I did not see anything at that action that went beyond it. Far, far from it, in fact. I thought that, you know, for the number of folks there, the organizers did a really good job of having, you know, having marshals, keeping people, you know, where they needed to be. That's why I was really disturbed that it ended with the arrests, you know, that it did. And, you know, furthermore, I think what's really important to, you know, to keep in mind, you know, housing justice is fundamentally in this country a matter of racial justice because of how, you know, we have as a country had, you know, hundreds of years of racist housing practices, forced segregation, and a massive disparity in eviction rates between white renters and Black renters. You know, and so I want to talk, you know, about a pattern that we seem to be seeing, you know, again, throughout the state. You know, we see law enforcement intimidating New Yorkers, exercising their constitutional rights to protest, and particularly those who are standing up for racial justice. And I mean, this was, you know, no exception, because good cause is fundamentally a racial justice issue. Housing stability and, you know, homelessness are not race neutral in this country. Nothing is race neutral in this country, but, you know, this is especially the case when you look at who is the most likely to suffer from evictions, housing instability, and homelessness in this country.
Carolyn, I have so many more questions about that day, but I do want to push forward a little bit before we run out of time. Some of those folks that were arrested at the protest in May were arraigned on June 7th. Protesters attended that arraignment at the Albany City Court. And the court, in the end, was forced to close for an extermination. I know you weren't there yourself. Advocates like Leanna Lightborn face a lot of charges after that incident on June 7th. I was just curious if you could fill us in on what happened at the Albany City Court.
We don't know who released the cockroaches at this point. I think some people have concluded that it was the protesters, but we don't actually know. And, you know, I do know Kleanna Lightborn, and she is someone I have, you know, a huge amount of respect for. She is a, you know, nationally prominent civil rights and racial justice leader, you know, who's really accomplished a lot in New York State. And so, you know, to see the charges, including a felony charge levied against her, it's very concerning. And I'm concerned because, you know, what we've seen elsewhere in the Capital Region is a pattern of seriously overcharging racial justice and Black Lives Matter activists. And often, you know, once we get folks connected to attorneys, those charges, you know, fall apart. You know, I'm going to wait until we get, you know, some more details, you know, from Kleanna's attorney about what really happened that day. We've seen this in Saratoga, we've seen this in Schenectady. And as to the particulars of this case, you know, I really want to hold out and see, you know, when she has a chance to defend herself, because right now what's been portrayed in the media is entirely coming, you know, from the prosecution.
That was producer Elizabeth Press speaking with Caroline Nagy. Kleanna Lightborn was fired from her job as a result of the events at the courthouse, and the community is pulling together to help with her legal fees. Her arraignment is scheduled for Tuesday, July 5th at 8 a.m. in Albany.
So on June 17th, the Sanctuary for Independent Media will screen the documentary film Witness about the notorious FBI pizza loan sting that targeted Muslims after 9/11. Attorney Kathy Manley, who helped defend Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hossein after their 2004 arrest in that sting, talks with Mark Dunley about the case.
We're talking with Kathy Manley, who is the legal director of the Coalition for Civil Freedom, and she was also an attorney in the case involving Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hossein. Basically, many people would say were framed after 9/11 on a so-called terrorist financing scheme, spent 15 years or so in prison. The sanctuary is hosting screening of a new film, Witness, on Friday, June 17th, from 7 to 10 p.m., I believe Kathy is one of the panelists, so we'll be discussing the film. So, you know, Kathy, why don't you just sort of briefly, you know, outline what your involvement was, you know, with this case as an attorney?
Sure, Mark. Thanks for having me. So back in 2004, I was working for Terry Kenlon as an associate attorney. And he was assigned to represent Yasin Arif. And in the beginning, I realized this is kind of an unusual, crazy case, but I didn't know that he was actually totally innocent.
in the very beginning. I didn't realize that. And it took me a while looking through all the evidence because it's very confusing, but gradually I started to realize that he actually did nothing wrong at all. And it was a sting operation. So, you know, the informant would say things on the tape and was supposed to let Yassin know that this was illegal, this loan to Mohammad Hossein, the co-defendant, who also didn't understand what he was supposed to understand in order to be convicted. Because the sting operation, it's supposed to be that these guys are trying to do something illegal, but they weren't really, especially Yassin had no idea. He was just witnessing this loan. And without going into all of that, because it would take, you know, I could talk about it for days and weeks, but we're not going to do that. You can watch the movie on the 17th. But I realized he was totally innocent. And, you know, at some point, I think the government realized that. And so then they framed two innocent people. They knew Mohammad Hossein had no desire in supporting terrorism. For some reason, they thought Yassin did, and this was just their way to catch him, even though he wasn't doing anything. And they thought he was somebody else, actually, who was killed in 2010. But so anyway, it was two totally innocent people that got entrapped. Well, like Mohammad got entrapped. Yassin didn't even have any idea anything illegal was going on. And we fought it as hard as we could. Terry Kinlan, the lead attorney, another attorney he worked with on the trial, myself and Steve Downs in the background doing a lot of research and various other things that you do to support the trial, and a lot of motions and things like that. But unfortunately, they both got convicted. And then we did a lot of preparation for sentencing. I think we got the sentence down from, I think it would have been 30 years. We showed there was so much support for these guys in the community. And they ended up both getting 15 years, which is still completely outrageous, but at least they're out now. And then I was the main person doing the appeal, and we kept trying and trying, and there was no way we ever won anything, even when we had new evidence showing it was a mistaken identity in the very beginning when they targeted Yassin. The federal law on habeas petitions after you do a direct appeal is so bad. I'm not going to even go into that because there's not time, right. But it was so bad. Anyway, you know, so eventually they got out, though. Thank God, you know.
Yeah. You know, and I believe they actually were found innocent, what was described as the most serious charges. And I also remember a woman I was working with in the peace movement at that time, and she was actually from Iraq. She was a school teacher over in Able Park, and she was quite upset that these gentlemen had been allegedly doing this and went to their initial arraignment to basically harangue them a bit afterwards. And she came back and just said, they are totally innocent. And, you know, listening to the government misinterpret particular words in our language, it's just astounding that this has gotten to this type of level. So what was your role with this movie, or how did that go?
So, yeah. Oh, and I think you were referring to maybe Mae Safar. She ended up starting, or maybe somebody else, but she ended up starting the Muslim Solidarity Committee along with Kathy Callan right after they got convicted. And I think you were around then, and you were definitely part of this whole thing. That, you know, we did a lot of support for sentencing with that group, and we did a lot of advocacy. But the movie, so Masood Haq, he's an emergency room physician who had done a prior movie about the case of Ansar Mahmood, and maybe other prior movies. But he, you know, got in touch with us, started working on this movie way back, maybe 12 years ago. I don't even know, a long time ago. We worked with him, and then he would kind of go back to working in the ER to raise more money, and then he would come back, and he changed it. He put so much of himself and his heart into this project over all these years. He actually changed it drastically many times, and the way it ended up being was, you know, after they were released, he decided, now I can talk to them directly. Since they're no longer in prison, there was no way he could do that before. The prison wouldn't allow it. So he actually has extensive interviews with both Yassin and Mohammad in this movie, which I hope people can see on the 17th at the sanctuary, and lets them tell the story in their own words, which was wonderful. So I'm glad he waited. I mean, it took forever, but it ended up being really good that way, that he could get their voices directly into it.
Now, one of the several, you know, co-sponsors of this film screening is a group that you've started, or at least the legal director, you know, the Coalition for Civil Freedom. You know, what are they doing?
Yeah, so it's really interesting how that group got started. After Yasina Muhammad's case, and we had the Muslim Solidarity Committee, and we were, you know, working on the sentencing and then the appeal. But after the sentencing, we also started looking to see, we thought this is like the only case like this, and we wanted to look at other cases to show how they were really terrorists and Yasin wasn't, you know, to argue for the appeal. But then we discovered, wait a minute, this is not the only case like this. There's actually a bunch of other cases where they're all a little bit different, but where Muslims after 9/11 were really, really unfairly convicted. And Steve Downs came up with the phrase preemptive prosecution. They were preemptively prosecuted to prevent the possibility of them ever doing something if the government was suspicious of them in any way. So these were really a lot of wrongful convictions we discovered. And we started Project Salaam to try to work with other people in other cases to advocate for these cases kind of in the Northeast. We had a case out of Syracuse, a case out of New York City, Dr. Dafir in Syracuse, Hashmi case in New York City. And then in 2010, when we were at the founding conference for UNAC, the peace group, which was in Albany, we got this mysterious invitation from this guy named Ali, who said, my dad, who's Sami Al-Arian, wants you, that would be Steve Downs and myself, to come meet him in his house because he wants to talk about these cases and he wants to help form an organization, a national organization to deal with this. And we were intrigued, but we were like, why do we have to go down there? Well, he's under house arrest because he was charged in one of these really unfair cases. He won at trial. He didn't get convicted of anything, got acquitted of all the major charges that they were trying to frame him on. He's Palestinian. I don't even want to talk about his case because that's another, I don't have time, but he was totally innocent. And, but he was still going to be deported. And anyway, he was under house arrest for a while. The government was still going after him really hard, even after he got acquitted and he had a couple minor charges there was a mistrial on. So he was under house arrest at the time in 2010 when we were invited to go down there. Oh, sorry. So yeah, we went down there. We met with him and a whole bunch of other people and we formed the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, which we have family conferences with the family members of people in these cases, and we work with the prisoners and we do legal work, compassionate release motions. We got three people released on compassionate release and we're working on a bunch more. So we're doing a lot of stuff and we could use a lot more support for our pen pal program and money that we give the prisoners and money for our legal work and everything else.
So we've been talking with Kathy Manley, Coalition for Civil Freedoms. The movie Witness will be on Friday, June 17th, 7 to 10 p.m. At Media Sanctuary of Independent Media. You can check out mediasanctuary.org for more details. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That's right. Kathy Manley will be one of the panelists with us on Friday. And in addition to the filmmaker Masood Heck, Lynn Jackson, and Larry Rulison. We look forward to seeing you on Friday.
And we finish tonight's show with our weekly weather update. In this segment, Blaze Bryant asks retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson about tornadoes.
Hey, Hugh, hope you had a good week.
I did. I had a great week. How about you?
I really can't complain. It was, it's a good week. Now we're into a new one. We got to lead off here with this storm that we were seeing, at least I was seeing a bunch of the time last week that we were going to get rain all week. And this thing just kept changing. And I just couldn't help but think to myself, if this thing were a yellow brick road that we're following, we'd be royally in a mess.
Yeah, well, you know, Blaze, the problem is, I think you got to understand, we were looking 4 or 5 days out. And, you know, we talked about this before. If you take a dart and you throw it a short distance and you're off a little bit, you might still get, you know, some points on the darts. The further you go, the more it will deviate. But what basically happened was the Miles were trying to phase two little pieces of energy into a pretty good nor'easter that looked like it would give us a bunch of rain starting midday Saturday and lingering into Sunday. And what ended up happening was a much weaker storm that stayed to our south. I know they got plenty of rain down in Philly. I have people, friends and family down there, and they were complaining it was kind of wet down there. But we were in a northwesterly flow, and we lucked out. We just didn't, you know, all the rain and all the forcing stayed south. Again, the Miles overproduced the storm. And that happens sometimes, especially in summer. We still get storms. We still get Miles forecasted that aren't perfectly correct. I mean, it's going to happen as long as I'm around. You know, it does a pretty good job. The Miles do it, but not perfect.
All right. Well, that certainly explains everything. So on to tornadoes. You said you wanted to talk about them. Where do you want to start?
Well, I want to start that we do get tornadoes every year in our county warning area. Again, the National Weather Service at Albany has 19 counties that we warn for. And I'd say we average a couple a year. A couple of years ago, we had 14. I think it was in 20. We had 14 confirmed tornadoes. That was by far a record. Now, the good news is most of them are very small. We get very small tornadoes, but they're still very dangerous. You don't want to be involved in one directly. In a car, it could suck your car up. It could hurt, damage your house. They're nature's most violent storm. They very, very small area of low pressure that is very concentrated, and winds can range anywhere from 65 miles an hour all the way up to past 200. Those are the EF4s and EF5s. We almost never get here, thank goodness. So I mean, those are the real ones that do the destruction. But we do get tornadoes here. We're not in Tornado Alley yet, but speaking of which, Tornado Alley has shifted a little further south and east due to climate change. It's moving a little further to the south and east than where it normally had been for years. So there is definitely an observation that's going on there. Now, it's still got a long way before it gets here, but it is moving a little south to the east. It's, you know, basically Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, up through very southern Minnesota. Those are usually your states that are involved in the Tornado Alley, but it is shifting a little further south and east.
So is that where Tornado Alley is now, or where it has been traditionally?
Traditionally, and again, we're talking maybe a 50-mile change, but there has definitely been a slight eastward jaunt to the Tornado Alley. But you can get tornadoes anywhere out of Tornado Alley. They've got them in Canada. They've gotten them in Florida, gets a fair amount. And a lot of times they get them in the winter. Almost every state has seen one. I think even Alaska has seen a tornado or two. They can happen anywhere where it's warm and cold air clashing together.
But a 50-mile jaunt, that's a relatively significant one in the grand scheme of things.
I agree. Absolutely. No question about it.
So we get Hugh Johnson, the largest one in terms of categories, usually what, the EF3s around here?
Yeah, yes, we've had in May 31st, 1998, I was one of the few meteorologists not working that day. That's the day that Mechanicville got hit head on by an EF3, and it damaged a lot of homes in Mechanicville. And I don't think it killed anyone. I think we had very good warnings out for it. But and I think that's the last EF3 we've had. We've had an EF2, we had one about 10 years after that in the Catskills. I'm trying to think if we've had any EF2s. We usually get EF0s and 1s. That's usually the most common ones. An EF4, there was one in Stockbridge, Massachusetts in 1973 that was EF4. Mm. And then there was one in Worcester, Mass., the only one in New England that was an EF5 on May 9th, I think, 1953, you know, a long, long time ago.
Gotcha. So I just learned something. There is actually a category called an EF0.
Yeah. So Fujita, a gentleman named Fujita, categorized the strength of tornado based on destruction. And he created a scale that goes from 0 to 5. It was redesigned about 5 years ago. It becomes an EF instead of just an F. But anyways, basically the idea is an EF0 is a sub hurricane tornado, sub-hurricane wind force tornado, basically, and it causes damage, but it's not that bad usually. And EF5 will obliterate brick buildings. It looked like a nuclear bomb went off. Mm-hmm. No, so you don't want to be in the path of an EF5. You do not want to be in the path of an EF5.
So is an EF0 then essentially between what a hurricane and a tornado is then?
Yes and no. They actually lowered the speeds a little bit on the winds when they redesigned the range. So it used to be that an EF0 was anything under 75 miles an hour. Actually, an EF0 is now between 65 and 85. They kind of narrowed the winds a little bit, but essentially it's a weak tornado. But don't let the weakness get you, because you could still get killed by an EF0.
Sure. So in a tornado, what should people do?
All right, we get a tornado. You don't want to be driving. You don't want to be in a mobile home. You want to go to in your house to an area where the house is the strongest structure, and that, believe it or not, is your bathroom. If you don't have a basement, if you have a basement, that's still the number one place to go underground. The next best place is a bathroom, because of the pipes and things like that. It kind of resupports the structure there. So you do not want to be in your car. Do not ever try to outdrive a tornado, because even though you might be going 70 and it's behind you, it could reform. It could redevelop right on top of you. That's happened so many times, or it might be another one developing in front of you. So do not drive. That's probably the most crucial thing. Obviously, if you're outdoors, the best you can do is get under some structure. But actually, you don't want to get under a bypass, like an underpass on a highway, because studies show that the winds get enhanced. So that's not necessarily a good place to be either. But
right.
If you're outside, you just basically lie down and pray. I mean, you really shouldn't. You should try to get indoors somewhere.
So is that why when the tornado stuff hits in Florida and you see all these mobile home parks essentially torn to shreds by these tornadoes, is that because, well, people are in their mobile homes because, oh, hell,
yes,
that's where they're living?
Yeah, that's where they don't. If I ever lived in a mobile home, the first thing I would find out is where the tornado shelter is, because a mobile home, it's like it just picks up like a leaf and just blows it, away. It's not the place you want to be. Absolutely. So yeah, mobile homes are, and they're vulnerable, because usually mobile homes are out in flat open areas, and tornadoes generally thrive in those areas, because when they hit resistance like hills or something like that, that obstructs the flow into them. So it can actually weaken them. Now, of course, a strong tornado is not going to be weakened. And we saw that in 2011, one hit Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And then there was that one in Joplin that killed a lot of people, even though there was a good warning out for that. Those were powerful tornadoes. They went right to the city. But smaller tornadoes probably will break up a little more likely to break up in cities.
Gotcha.
That's what we usually have, small tornadoes or weaker ones.
Okay, give me your 45-second forecast here, Hugh.
Okay, for the day, it looks like a nice day today, nice tomorrow. Looks like some chance of showers later in the week. We got to watch for a cutoff low developing, and that's going to determine our weather starting late in the week till next week. If it cuts off right over us, it's going to turn showery. But right now, models favor forming just a little far enough to our east that we stay in that sweet spot in the northwesterly flow, sinking motions, and we could actually have very nice weather. But we're going to have to keep an eye on that, because if it cuts off any further west, we're going to have a period of unsettled weather. So keep an eye to the forecast this weekend, because it could change.
As it always seems to do, because it's weather in the northeast.
Indeed. And it stays very hot. The real hot weather stays mainly to our west right now.
All right. Well, very good, Hugh. We have to leave it there. Thank you very much. We'll catch up next week.
All right. Have a great week there, Blaze.
You too.
And our weekly weather update comes to you every week. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
I'm Kathy Silver. Our engineer is Sina Bazila-Hickey. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, Thanks for tuning in.